Right now on the Daily Debrief, the Secretary of Labor defends his conduct back when he was a prosecutor in the case of an accused billionaire pedophile. Plus,
it is that simple. He wanted to get caught.
The state of Florida asks jurors to put an admitted killer to death. The defense begs for his life.
Our system is set up so that mercy tempers justice.
And
what they saw shocked their conscience.
A little girl dead, two foster parents accused, and evidence goes flying during opening statements. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Wednesday, July 10th.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. Good evening, Linda. Good to see you here. We are talking about a lot of cases. Let's start with the Secretary of Labor, who is speaking out about his handling of the case of an alleged billionaire sex predator who was just this week arrested on new charges. Alexander Acosta, as a former federal prosecutor in Florida, was involved in a sweetheart deal which allowed accused predator Jeffrey Epstein to escape serious federal charges and instead serve a year in a local jail on state charges only. Epstein is now accused of federal crimes in New York, new charges which could put him behind bars for the rest of his life. Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross has been following the case for months and joins us from our newsroom tonight.
Good afternoon, Eric. Well, with Democrats calling for his resignation over that he be fired, Acosta took a public stance today, expressing no regrets, no apologies, said he did the best he could in making the deal with Jeffrey Epstein.
Because we now have 12 years of knowledge and hindsight, and we live in a very different world. Today's world treats victims very, very differently. Today's world does not allow some of the victim shaming that could have taken place at trial 12 years ago. Today's world understands that when interviewing victims, when eliciting testimony, that testimony can be sometimes contradictory, that memories are difficult. And so I don't think we can say, you know, take a case that is this old and fully know how it would play out today.
But these victims say you failed them.
I understand what the victims say, and I'm not here to try to say that I can stand in their shoes or that I can address their concerns. I'm here to say we did what we did because we wanted to see Epstein go to jail. He needed to go to jail. He needed to go to jail. And that was the focus.
But Acosta said that he went to jail. The fact is that Epstein went to jail for almost 13 months in a county jail in Palm Beach, Florida, and was allowed to leave the jail 5 days a week to go to his office. Hardly a tough settlement, hardly a tough punishment, Aaron.
Brian, the official explanation is now on the record, though, at least after that discussion today.
Exactly. And of course, Acosta was probably trying to appeal to an audience of one, the president, who apparently was watching closely to see how he would defend himself. Democrats continue to call for Acosta to be fired.
Exactly. Brian Ross reporting from the newsroom tonight. Closing arguments now in the penalty phase of a trial against a convicted Florida murderer who took the stand and said he was a homicidal maniac and wanted to be put to death. Scott Nelson told the jury he secured a job and a roof over his head after he was released from prison on an unrelated bank robbery. Then he said his probation officer got him thrown out on the streets. So he killed victim Jennifer Fulford because he said he needed money. He called Fulford, quote, collateral damage. Here is how the state wrapped up this case.
This was a calculated plan that he had. There was a purpose behind every step he took. From buying the supplies to where he left the body, in broad daylight, in a field, he wanted to get caught. Everything he did after that was part of his plan. Using the ATM, not hiding his identification in any way, shape, or form. Using his own name to buy a train ticket, standing in front of as many cameras as he possibly could on the buses, at the Publix, in the Amtrak train station. He wanted to get caught. And he wanted to make sure that he was prosecuted, because that's the only way he guarantees taking that witness stand. It was all part of the plan, and he accomplished it. The state has proven to you, beyond to the exclusion of any reasonable doubt, that this murder was cold. It was calculated, and it was premeditated to a heightened extent. He knew exactly what he was doing.
The defense still sought to save the defendant's life, even though he said he wanted to be executed.
We have shown you that this is not one of those cases that is the most aggravated and least mitigated. In this case, there's significant mitigation to weigh against any aggravation you may find. Our system is set up so that mercy tempers justice, okay? And part of that process is truly considering Mr. Nelson's individual circumstances. He is the one that you are called upon to decide whether he lives or dies. And in this case, you've heard evidence of Mr. Nelson's individual circumstances, including his abusive and later absent father, his mentally ill mother, his physically abusive older brothers, his decades of alcohol and drug abuse, and finally, his decades of incarceration, including solitary confinement and years of abuse suffered. You've heard that Mr. Nelson has been diagnosed with several mental disorders, mental illness including post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, bipolar disorder, cognitive deficits, problems with executive functioning, and possible autism spectrum disorder.
Joining me tonight is attorney Linda Canny Bodden. Linda, this has been a trial of extremes all the way around here. Wonderful. But bottom line, great advocacy by the state there.
Absolutely great advocacy. And, you know, by the defense, not bad. I mean, this is a nightmare of a client. He gets up, he says, I'm a homicidal maniac, right? I mean, what are you going to do with him except say, you know, maybe life in prison is better. Maybe he thinks the cost is prosecuting him and he'll get a deal. I don't know.
Okay. Your opinion. Okay. I know you're chomping at the bit about that.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I didn't really set up a lot of discussion about that. I should have. But bottom line here, yeah, the defense really had very few things that the defense could do other than just beg for mercy, because I can't picture a worse situation for the defense at this point.
Right, exactly. What you're hoping for is a juror is going to say, okay, maybe he has some kind of, maybe he'll be good in prison. There's something that maybe he can offer, or let's put him away because it's worth for him to spend the rest of his life rather in prison. But you know what, Aaron? He's going to die of old age anyhow, even if he gets a death penalty. So it almost doesn't matter effectively.
We'll wait for the verdict in this case. And now to the trial of a Georgia couple accused of murdering their 2-year-old foster child. Joseph and Jennifer Rosenbaum face a mix of murder and other charges related to the death of Layla Marie Daniel. Authorities say the little girl died from blunt force trauma to the abdomen, a cut pancreas, and other abuse. The defendants say the girl died accidentally by choking on a chicken tender. Here's how the prosecution started off the state's case.
There was no choking, there was no choking. What the evidence will show is that there was a severe, brutal beating that day. And we're going to be clear, it wasn't the first time. This one was just the worst one. They get Layla into the ambulance and take her to the hospital. And because it's a baby, they'll tell you she didn't have any breath. She didn't have any pulse. But nobody wants a baby to be dead on their watch. So they worked and they worked and they worked. When they got into the hospital staff worked and worked and worked. But it was too late. She was gone. So everybody, as you have to do when it's a child that is dead, let's stop, let's take a breath, and let's look. And when they looked, what they saw shocked their conscience. Layla was bruised from head to toe.
That's how it started, but the prosecutor's zealous tactics went too far at one point. Here the prosecutor grabs a defense exhibit, shows it to the jury, and then throws it aside. The defense jumped in and the judge did too. See it now for yourself.
Everybody's believing that, they are just this big, happy family. Oh, woe is them. These babies, oh my God, she's lost a child. We need to gather around her. A facade.
Excuse me, that was my poster that you just threw over.
Excuse me. Excuse me. Oh. Take it up.
A facade, ladies and gentlemen. That's what they want to show you, this picture-perfect family. But that's not what it was.
After that, the defense pressed its theory that this was an accident, but that the death of an innocent victim led the state to go too far.
What was a horrible accident was going to be turned into a vendetta against these two folks. A vendetta that has continued to this very day, to this very minute, when Miss Young got up here and continued that vendetta. Someone has to be blamed. A child is dead. Someone has to pay. And what they're doing is mixing bad medicine together with sensationalism and blaming the first easy target instead of looking for the truth of the matter and seeing what really happened and seeing it for the accident it was.
Back to Linda Kenney-Bodden quickly on this case. So, Linda, look, here's my concern with what the prosecutor did. When the performance detracts from the content, that's a problem.
Yeah, and, you know, I love her. I love her opening. Daisha Young, she was passionate, but that went over the line. In New Jersey, you wouldn't be able to do that. And you heard the judge pick it up. There was no, it was clear to the jury that was a problem.
Exactly, and I think the judge handled it perfectly because the judge didn't really scold the prosecutor. The judge didn't need to. Doing what the judge did was almost worse than a scold.
Right.
Admit your mistake, it was like watching a child being scolded almost.
Right, right, absolutely. The judge wasn't going to endanger the child, wasn't going to endanger what the jury felt, but he made it very clear, don't do it again.
The chicken tender defense, what do you make of that?
I'm waiting for the chicken tender. If there's a chicken tender, it would have been in the throat or in the stomach. I'm waiting for the autopsy. Was it there?
A lot of information we're waiting to see roll out in this case. It's expected to last quite some time, so we will monitor it, of course. We are also hoping to bring you the sentencing hearing this Friday of Brittany Zamora. She's the Arizona teacher who pleaded guilty to sex crimes involving her underage student. A court hearing is scheduled tomorrow on the extent of broadcast coverage the judge will allow during Friday's hearing. We will keep you posted on exactly what we can show you. And still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, the case of a 12-year-old girl murdered in Tennessee. Does DNA tell who did it or unfairly cast a maintenance man as a murderer? That case when we return. Now to the case against a Tennessee man accused of murdering a 12-year-old girl. Roy Coons Jr. is accused of killing 12-year-old Joanna Ortega by beating and strangling her. Ortega was home from school because of a roller skating injury. She texted her mother that someone was knocking on her door at about 4:15 p.m. She thought the person was the man who mowed the family's lawn. Her mother found her dead 2.5 hours later. The prosecution said the DNA would help prove a link between the victim and the defendant, but it is not the only evidence in this case which favors the state. Here, a DNA analyst testifies that while two samples from the scene matched the defendant, 23 others excluded him.
And all of that data was put into the computer and preliminary results were produced for each of the 25 items.
And did any of your preliminary results show any connection with Roy Coons?
Other than the window frame we talked about, there was also a match between that cigarette butt and Mr. Coons.
And the was your analysis able to exclude him from all of those particular samples?
From the other 23 items, yes, exclusionary match statistics were produced.
The defense seized on the net lack of DNA linking the defendant to the scene. Keep in mind, the defendant did maintenance work on the victim's home, and the defense says that explains what investigators did find.
You tested all of those. You only had two that matched Roy Coons Jr.
There was also a cigarette butt from parking lot, item 15.
Okay. That was outside lot C4.
Yes, that's correct.
All the other DNA that you tested, you didn't even obtain a partial profile related to Roy Coons Jr.
Of all the other ones that I was able to compare, I was not able to positively associate any of those with his DNA profile.
The victim's sister took the stand to describe her family's interactions with the accused killer leading up to her sister's death. We cannot show you this sister's face, but we can hear her testimony.
During the time that you would be home alone with your sister or your brother, did you ever allow Mr. Roy Coons to come inside the trailer?
Never.
Did you or your brother and sister in your presence ever hang out and laugh and shake hands with Roy Coons?
Never.
In what kind of situation would you ever see Mr. Coons?
When he was outside, usually. It was always outside. When my mom would talk to him about mowing our yard, things like that, yeah.
Was he someone that you would go up and have conversations with or talk to?
No.
The victim's mother emotionally testified about finding her daughter's body.
Yo toqué a Joanna. Estaba fría.
I touched Joanna, and she was cold.
What part of her body did you touch?
¿Qué parte de su cuerpo tocó?
Toqué su brazo.
I touched her arm.
Ella estaba fría.
She was cold. I knew that she had been hurt.
Can you describe her clothing?
¿Puede describir su ropa?
No. Ella tenía pantalón más abajo de lo normal.
She had her pants lower than normal.
Tenía una cinta de karate en el cuello.
She had a karate belt in her neck.
Tenía dos vueltas.
She had two rounds of it.
Tenía dos vueltas y estaba amarrada por la parte de atrás con doble nudo.
It had two rounds of, around the neck and it was tied in the back with a double knot.
Estaba demasiado apretada.
It was too tight.
Su cuello lucía demasiado delgado.
Her neck looked very too thin.
Ella tenía sangre en la boca.
And she had blood in her mouth.
Yo sabía que sabían hecho daño a mi nena.
I knew that someone had hurt my girl.
Le dije, Jocelyn, pásame el 911.
I told Jocelyn, give me the 911.
El 911 comenzó a darme instrucciones. Yo le quité la cinta del cuello.
911 started giving me instructions and I took the belt off her neck.
Su cuello estaba muy delgado.
Her neck was very, very thin.
The first officer on the scene explained what happened next.
I then went back to the room, checked pulse real quick, noticed that she had been deceased at that time.
Now, even if a person is obviously deceased on the scene, is it standard practice once the EMTs, medical personnel show up, that they standard practice will put on the little pads and run up?
Yes, ma'am.
To confirm death?
Yes, ma'am.
And was that done?
Yeah. I mean, the medical personnel was on scene probably 2 minutes after we arrived.
What, if anything, did you notice about Johanna Ortega's injury?
She had ligature marks on her neck at the time. I could tell something was wrong. It was confirmed a couple seconds later after medical personnel got there that they even noticed that she had ligature marks on her neck.
During opening statements, the state said the defendant's suspicious behavior and bizarre statements are some of the most damaging pieces of evidence against him.
So while he's down there hiding out in the homeless camp, his neighbor in the tent next to him is an individual you'll meet by the name of Moses. Moses O'Cock. And they will come in here and they will tell you about their encounters with Mr. Coons. They'll tell you about some statements that he made to them.
questions such as, do you think God would forgive someone for killing someone? And then trying to convince them to leave with him and go to California, that he planned to do that as soon as he got his check. He was going to be gone, wanted them to leave with him. And then the very eerie conversation where Roy Coons Jr., who they knew by the nickname of Ray, said, Moses, have you ever killed anybody? No. Well, I have.
Linda Kinney Bodden, back again one more time to discuss this third case that we're covering right now. So, Linda, you know, the testimony is just so raw. We watched the mother yesterday, the sister we heard from today. This is the real deal. This yes. is someone's life who is lost. It's someone who is loved. I have to go back to the evidence, though, and look at what the state has here. The state says the window was pried open into the girl's room, and the defendant's DNA was on the windowsill. So the defense is saying you don't have it in a lot of places, but that one key spot, that might be enough.
Enough, along with the fact you do have it on their buttocks. So what they look for is, like, if you're a woman and her pants are pulled down, they're looking at the seams here where pants can be pulled, and where on the buttocks would be important. And the fact that there's no other massive DNA of anybody else in that secure area, basically, her butt.
Do you buy the defense theory that this was just because he was doing maintenance work on the property and that's why his DNA was all over the place?
It could be, but not coupled with the admission, if it's true, that indeed he admitted to killing somebody else and also the DNA on the window and there's nobody else, and he would have access to her. He would know that she's home. And she sent a text saying, I think it's the man who cuts the grass at the door, knocking at the door. That's it. To me, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of these things where each one of these pieces of evidence may be a little something here and a little something there, but when you start adding it all up, it's not just the forensics,
right.
It's not just the text message, it's the statements of the defendant himself, and when you add it all up, this is a strong case, in my opinion, for the state.
Absolutely, and when you think about it, it's a good example of why the police have to not just rely on lab work, they have to do good old-fashioned police work and get statements from people and do an investigation.
You know, so many cases here, we look and we say it's a strong case for the state, it's a weak case for the state, and exactly, this is the thing, don't just rely on
right.
one smoking gun answer. Keep looking for answers. And this is one of those cases that looks like it was done that way. Linda Kinney Bodden, a panel of one tonight. We appreciate you joining us for the debrief. We'll be back here at 5 o'clock tomorrow with our recap of cases nationwide.